Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, episode 71.
Life. I'm not gonna hurt you. You didn't let me finish my sentence. I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in. I'm gonna bash them right the fuck in.
Stay away from me.
Jack,
what?
Where are we going?
I don't know. I'll tell you when we get there.
Okay, because.
You really scared me, you shithead.
Are you gonna help me up or what?
Please, God.
This is God.
Hello, and welcome to the Plain Label Podcast. I am your host, Rachel Zelag, and along with me, I have my good friend and co-host, Eric Hannah Williams. Ooh, I like that. It rolls off the tongue.
I like that, too. I have a cousin named that, so there you go. And
I'm
Eric Williams. I'm not asleep like Rachel sounds like she is.
I'm not asleep.
Okay.
I've only had one beer.
Alrighty.
And for this episode, we are joined by Annelle Strauss and Cameron Rice later.
Yeah, Cameron's running a little late, but we do have Strauss with us again here.
Hello.
Hi. We continue our look at horror films with a discussion on three horror films from the 80s. In this episode, we are taking a look at The Shining, An American Werewolf in London, and The Nightmare on Elm Street. Before doing that, we would like to mention we are proud members of the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of their other shows. Okie doke. It's drink roll call time, and we'll start with the ladies first. So, Eric?
Oh, nice. Okay, so this is something that I got from a restaurant today. From a grocery store today. It'd have been a lot more expensive if I got it from a restaurant. It was like $2, literally. It was like $2.50. And it is from the company called Winking Owl. It's from California, and it's a Pinot Grigio, and it is a first time for both Strauss and myself, and she's given me a nasty look after taking her first taste.
No, giving you a nasty look because you moved the bottle away from me.
Oh, okay. What? So
I can't control the pores? Or...
Why don't you tell me what you think of this, Strauss?
It's pretty good. It's good for $2. I'll give you that.
Good for $2. All right, Cruiser, what do you have?
I am, since it's the middle of fall, I'm drinking New Belgium Tour de Fall, and it's a Oktoberfest-y type of beer. It's pretty good.
It sounds good. That is really sweet, by the way. Holy shit! You may be hearing a lot. You're gonna hear a lot of in this one.
Yeah.
Smacking of the
gums. Is it red?
No, it's like a really shiny white. It was something you'd be all about it too. I should have told this to you. That same grocery store has some Riesling, and it is also about $2.50 or so.
Yeah, this makes you go.
I like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead and move on to our discussion here finally. And like we said, we're gonna have Cameron join us at some point. He's got something going on. He'll be here as soon as he can. And our first pick is Rachel's selection. It is from 1980, and it is The Shining.
Thank you.
man, his son, and wife become the winter caretakers of an isolated hotel where Danny, the son, sees disturbing visions of the hotel's past using a telepathic gift known as The Shining. The father, Jack Torrance, is underway in a writing project when he slowly slips into insanity as a result of cabin fever and former guests of the hotel's ghosts. After being convinced by a waiter ghost to correct the family, Jack goes completely insane. The only thing that can save Danny and his mother is The Shining.
Okay, so this, like we said, is from 1980. This is a Stanley Kubrick film. This is based on the Stephen King novel. This was famously not the vision that Stephen King wanted. He was not pleased with this adaptation of his work. And he had a USA Network TV miniseries made in the 90s, I believe, starring Steven Weber and Rebecca De Mornay, and it was not very good. It was not nearly the film that this is, but that is... and so I guess people really want to check that
out. Isn't Steven Weber from Wings?
Yeah, Steven Weber from Wings, yeah, the younger brother. And nice. It's not very good at all.
I'm sure.
With that being said, this is your selection. And
yes.
I feel like I don't know if I want to say bullied, maybe shamed, maybe persuaded you into selecting this. And why did I make you choose this one, Cruz?
Well, I'm sure that you wanted me to, like, wanted to talk about it. And I was like, I need one because, like, my theme was, you know, like, naked and naughty stuff. And you're like, I think there's like naughty stuff in here. And I was like, okay. And that's kind of how it went. So like, there wasn't a lot of bullying. It was just like me saying, okay, that's fine.
Yeah. But I think the reason that it was brought up was I said, well, the Shining had been brought up and you said that you had not seen the film.
Right.
And I couldn't hardly believe it. So that's why.
I couldn't hardly believe it.
Yeah, so that's why I had you. I suggested that you should pick this one. So you don't have any history with this one, Strauss. What about you? Do you have a history with this film?
I saw it once a few years ago, but it was better this time.
And she claims that it wasn't the sequel. She claims she hasn't seen any of the sequels of these first.
Yeah, these are.
She didn't accidentally watch like an American in Paris.
Oh yeah, no, right? American Werewolf in Paris. That is a terrible movie.
No, an American in Paris with Gene Kelly.
No, she didn't see that.
She's like, I didn't think that was scary at all.
I don't see any fucking werewolves. What's that?
There's no blood.
Yeah. So you liked this time around?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I clearly enjoy this film quite a bit. It's one that I've seen probably like a dozen times or so. I have read the book. It's,
He's gonna go all cabin fever on me pretty soon here, I guess.
It's one of those where I think that the book and the film are much different, but they are both equally successful. And one of the things that I think we should get out of the way, and maybe I'll bring this up again when Cameron gets out on here and starts discussing this, but there is a documentary sort of based on this film, but it's also based on the films of Stanley Kubrick, and it's called Room 237. Which of course is is where The Shining is happening in the Overlook Hotel. And it's a lot about these different people that have theories about what Kubrick is saying in his different films. They talk about Eyes Wide Shut quite a bit, which is a film that we have coming up on Podshots here in about 2 weeks. He talks about this film and a lot of the hidden meanings, whether Kubrick meant it was like a metaphor for the way that Europeans treated Native Americans because of it's on a Indian burial ground. And if you look at different shots, there's all this Native American stuff in the background. And there's all this detail about how the film doesn't make sense in some ways because there's like impossible rooms based on the layout of the hotel. A window wouldn't be in a certain place, like a room wouldn't be oriented in a certain way. And Kubrick is very well known for being a director that pays very strict attention to every shot. And he wouldn't let something like that go by on accident to where
how do people know that a room is not oriented the right way?
Well, you watch it obsessively and you make a diagram of the hotel.
What about
that doesn't sound weird at all.
Yeah.
What about the door when he's bashing it in and how one side was open and he hadn't bashed the other side and we noticed how
I noticed that too.
Yeah.
That seemed pretty simple to not
There's things like that, and then there's there's the stories of the repeated takes and the mental breakdown that he caused on our leading lady, Olive Oil, Shelley Duvall. And
why did she have mental breakdown?
Because he allegedly, both Jack Nicholson and Stanley Kubrick were very hard on her. They were very demanding of her, but you know, I want to say Kubrick had them, the scene that we played at the beginning of this episode, which is with Jack and Wendy walking up the stairs and she hits him with the bat after he's gone crazy. They supposedly did that scene 100 times or so.
You know, her arms look tired with that bat.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, she's swinging like a sissy.
Yeah. Cruise would go right for the midsection and it'd have some power behind it.
I wouldn't let him, well, I mean, like, I would probably get him to the top of the stairs and then whack him like she did, but, you know, so he could fall all the way down, but.
Yeah. So there's just little things, that don't seem to make sense in this film that is inconsistent with all of his other films, where all of his other films are so very meticulous. And this one is the one that is not. So people are always grasping for why and what it means. And if he's saying more than what it seems he's saying. Now, that being
said. Couldn't it be that he was just like drunk?
No. That being said, the documentary is a piece of shit and I do not suggest anyone watch it.
Oh no.
It just has six like random people. Like it could be the three of us and three other jackholes just talking about, well, my theory is this, because it's not anyone that's credited for having any sort of insight. It's just like really big fans of his work.
Wasn't there one theory about something about the moon landing too? Because the little kid had the, okay.
Yeah, the Apollo thing because of his sweater.
Right.
And the way that the tennis ball is thrown to him and the shape of the carpet that he's on. Similar shapes, and it's all this, all these theories about how, you know, it was Kubrick that had faked the moon landing, and we've never actually been to the moon, and this whole thing. And that's an actual thing. Like, people are actually very, convinced that, you know, that we've never been on the moon, and it's all a hoax. And that, I mean, if someone wants to waste an afternoon, that, go down that rabbit hole and get on YouTube and look at that. And, you'll thank the Lord for the upbringing that you have, that you didn't end up like them. So, like I said, I really like the film. So I've gone on and on and on. Cruz, since this is a first watch for you, why don't you tell me what you thought of it?
Well, it's weird that you said that the book and the movie are so different. Like, how different are they?
It's pretty different. I mean, some of the things that are a big key in the books, in the book is, like the boiler that they make sure and tell him that he needs to check. It's part of his maintenance.
Right.
That is a thing where it's like a temperamental thing where he has to check it constantly. He has a, like, you know, it has a, basically like an alarm and he has to go down there and check it. And if he doesn't check it in time, the whole thing is going to blow up. And so as he starts becoming more seduced by The Shining, by this hotel, he starts becoming more lax on his things. And it's like another instance of, you know, the hotel sort of taking over and trying to kill these people.
Okay.
And the hedges, it's not a hedge maze. They're hedge animals and they like start coming to life and it's a whole thing. There's a lot more with the costume play and the blowjobs and all that, like that's a lot more in depth in the film. In the book.
Okay. I thought it was just really weird that there was a hedge maze anywhere. by a hotel.
You're just, you wouldn't be able to hack it, so it was just startling to you.
Okay. Well, that having been said, the main parts of the story were, to me, pretty Stephen King-ish. That makes sense. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
He does simplistic in its frightfulness, if that's a thing. He doesn't have these, these huge, scary, detail-oriented, blah, blah plots. It's I feel like he just, goes into his, weird, creepy, dark place, and he's like, what if this? And then, goes from there. Because this is basically, what if these people get killed by a hotel? And, that's kind of what happens, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you can tell, the way that it builds, it's just so simple how it's building, but, at the same time, it's obviously just scaring the shit out of you.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, there's some music, but, mostly it's just, the wind and footsteps. So I thought, I really liked that, too, where it was just, click-clacking down the hallway. I don't know.
The tricycle on the wood floor.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the creepiest sound in the world. Because it would like tricycle and then carpet. Tricycle, carpet. And it's stop doing that, kid. Stop riding around on your...
Yeah. And every time he turns the corner, you're like, oh, my God, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, you kept waiting for the girls to be there. You kept waiting for something to happen. Now, since you had yet to see this, how much of this was... ruined, spoiled for you? How much of this did you know about it? Because I know that shows like Family Guy has parodied this quite a bit.
I knew that he went nuts.
Mm-hmm.
So I had seen that part somewhere before. And I knew that there were little weird girls in the hallway. And Here's Johnny is so full of pop culture that, I knew that that was a part of it where he has an axe. And I assume, you can piece it together because, like I said, the plot isn't really detailed. The thing that I forgot was that little weird person that the kid talks to whole time.
Yeah, Tony.
Yeah, that was disturbing. And then I forgot that the book was just the same, one sentence over and over again.
Oh, yeah. His story that he'd been writing forever.
So.
What do you think,
right.
Strauss, let me ask you this. How in the world do you think that both Danny and the Grady girls are able to miss so much school? It was one of the things that I hadn't thought about it until now. They're talking about taking them out from, basically October to
May
or April or something like that. It's how the shit would they miss all the school time and that would be okay? They're just homeschooled?
I have no idea. It seemed like when they were even living in their apartment, they were still new to that place.
Right? Yeah, because they'd only been in Colorado for 3 months or something.
Then they must have just not enrolled him, and maybe they were going
to
just...
No, because he went to school because they asked how he liked it, and he said that he didn't like it very much.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe she was going to homeschool him, but instead she's smoking and eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches at the same time, which is really gross.
Yeah. Gross.
That was pretty gross. The other thing that I liked about the beginning was I love the opening shot, the complete desolation that you get of that helicopter shot and how far away the hotel is from anything. And there's lakes and there's just this windy little road. And it's holy shit. This is out in the fucking middle of nowhere. And so I really like that. And then one of the other things that I think can maybe go a little bit unnoticed, but is something that I really, really liked was when Wendy is describing how Danny hurt his arm and about how she's like, well, it's just a thing that happened. And, my husband, cause she doesn't even call him Jack. She just says, my husband. She's like, my husband, went and he pulled him and it just, and hurt his arm. It's just one of those things. Yeah. And I was like, oh, this fucking lady, she needs to figure out who her husband is real quick.
Another thing, cause I had taken so much time to watch this cause it's been, so long since this was actually a movie, a new movie, obviously. that, like, I've seen Jack Nicholson, or, is that his name?
Jack Nicholson?
Yeah.
Oh, that just sounds weird.
I'm getting confused with Jack Nicholas.
That's right.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've seen him in so many other things being ridiculous that, like, I couldn't even remember at the beginning if he was, like, a nice guy or not.
Mm.
Like, did he have the propensity to be this asshole the whole time, or was, like, was it the hotel's fault? You know what I mean? Like, it'd be different, like, if it was, like, Tom Hanks that went all crazy eyes.
Mm.
He'd be like, oh my god, this hotel is evil. But, like, seeing him in that role, I'm like, well, he's always been kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he, well, I think that what's important here is that he's putting on a show when he goes and has the interview. It's like, you know, oh, I'm ready for anything. This is exactly what our family needs. I'm actually working on a writing project. This is going to be great. And then he starts to lose it a little bit. But at one point when he's basically face down on a desk and he's screaming. And Wendy comes in and gets him, and he's essentially being attacked by the Overlook in his mind. And that's another thing, if I'm right, that is more detailed in the book, because you can go into his head in the book. But
oh, sure.
It's where he's being sort of possessed or controlled or whatever you want to call it by the hotel, and he's trying not to be a bad guy. He's not a perfect man, but he's not there to murder them.
Okay.
And he's not necessarily a good guy, but he's not a murderous lunatic. And they just kind of push him over the edge, and they do so with his vice, which is the booze.
But still, when they were driving, when they were driving to the hotel, the way that he talks to her is very condescending, and he treats her like, I know you're not smart and you're annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't seem to have much time for her.
No. And I remember, like, even before he was getting, like, super crabby, he, like, told her to get out or something, like, right.
Yeah.
At the beginning, I'm like, oh no, I don't like that.
Yeah.
Of course, she is, like, the most funny-looking person I've ever seen in my life, so.
Yes, she is. She definitely is. So, let's see what Mr. Cameron has to say about this film.
The Shining, I think, is a movie. You know, there's those things in childhood, but you can't get rid of the images. Maybe good things, maybe bad things, but memories pop up. I'd say about The Shining, the melting woman in the tub. That is plastered on there like Superman's S on what's his name in Superman Part 2. That's never getting off my mind.
Because you enjoy it so much.
Hey, that freaked me out. That still, as an adult watching that sequence, still is like, you get the heebie-jeebs, you know what I'm talking about? just like, you feel like goosebumps getting over your skin. And and it's not the nudity, it's the sound, it's that cackling laugh. It's the same thing when I watch a Night of the Living Dead, when the little girl's stabbing her mother with a shovel and the scream echo is happening.
Mm.
It's the audio effect of it all that's like, ooh.
I don't know, I would say that I was and still am pretty scared of the soggy vagina, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that's icky.
I think, as we've discovered on the show, Eric has weird woman issues. looking at weird boobs in the last one, the James Bond one, he's calling some old woman a lesbian because she's ugly. We get it.
Yeah, well, my secret's out.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, what can you do? So, Strauss, I haven't really asked you too much. What did you, you said that you liked it. What is it that you enjoyed about the film?
I liked the thrill of it. I don't know. It was, for the second watch for me, I watched it a lot more intently. I think before I was just kind of like watching it and there was people around and it wasn't like scary.
Oh, it was like a party watch.
Yeah.
That's how you want to watch it, like a football game, you know?
Yeah. And it wasn't fun. And this time I was like really watching it and it freaked me out. Like I was getting all into how, the house was possessing him, and I felt really sorry for the kid and the mom, like just having that empathy for them, just feeling like, well, that would suck to have that happen. And the poor woman who has no backbone. I just wanted to jump in there and talk shit for her because she couldn't.
Right?
She couldn't say anything. And I was just like, oh, man, if anyone were to talk to me like that, oh, hell no.
Well, bringing up Shelley Duvall, have you guys talked about the hell she went through making the movie?
Sure.
Just a little bit.
Go ahead.
Not a lot.
Oh, like the fact that Stanley Kubrick is notorious for doing take after take after take. Scatman Crothers cried during the making of this movie because he had him do 80 takes of, I think it might have been the scene with Danny.
Yeah, the ice cream cone scene, right?
Yeah, the ice cream cone scene. And he finally broke down and said to Kubrick, what is it you want me to do? And it was Jack Nicholson had to take Kubrick aside and be like, okay, why don't we calm down a little bit? So Shelley Duvall, similar thing. She's in the movie way more than Scatman. She got so stressed out her hair started to fall out by the end of the
making
of this
movie. Oh, my God.
Well, it looked good on screen.
Yeah, no shit.
She looked ragged.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's like, you know, we talked about Texas Chainsaw where it's like the reality of that situation. These people were stressed out making this movie. Except for maybe Jack Nicholson. If you watch the documentary, he's laughing and having a beer. He's having a great old time.
Yeah, he seems to be having a good time. Yeah.
It's like in his element.
Yeah, and Danny seems to be all right because he doesn't really seem to have any idea what he's really doing, you know, like what he's really making.
Yeah, it's the resilience of a little kid.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, so we talked about Shelley Duvall and her sort of problems. So I want to say, you know, what is everyone's favorite scene? Is it the room 237 sequence? Is it the elevator blood? Is it the, I'm not going to hurt you, I'm just going to bash your brains in? Like, Cruz, what is your favorite scene?
My favorite is just like at the end when he just like loses his shit. And just starts hacking at the door and like she is freaking out and she's still like, you know, just scared to shit of him. And like he, like the looks that he gives are just ridiculous. Like he, just the faces that he makes, like he can be creepy at any time during the day. And so like when he finally just loses it, I think it was my favorite part because he's just like, he just went crazy eyes.
Yeah. Strauss, what about you?
I like towards the end when after he bashed in the door, when they're trying to get out, just that feeling when you get, when you're just like, oh, I hope they make it. And when they're running through the maze and then finally they get in the cat or whatever it is and drive away. I love that kind of feeling that you get in a scary movie.
That's sort of, being tense and then the release of, oh, okay, they made it.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting about this film is even though Anel had seen it before, and I'd seen it several times, like I said, I had fallen asleep on a rewatch, and she refused to keep watching it because she was all freaked out. And she was like,
I was scared. I was like, I need you to be ready for this.
Well, yeah, that happens.
Way to go.
Yeah, that happens often.
Yeah.
I would say that my favorite scene is probably the when Jack wakes up in the dry, like the pantry or whatever you want to call it,
yes.
All the dry food.
Dry storage.
Yeah, and when he's there and he's like taunting Wendy and banging on the door, like that's the one where I'm like, oh man, like he's in a spot where there's no realistic way that he should ever be able to get out. But yet he still has power over her and over the situation because he's fucking crazy at that point. And I really appreciated that. My close second would be the reveal of the writing because I'm like, oh, what a fucking mind fuck that is.
Well, I'll say, like,
I know.
The most memorable scene is the bathtub scene. My favorite scene is actually probably the bar scene.
Oh, with the
kids? With Lloyd. Hey, Lloyd. Because so much of this movie, obviously, because Kubrick is like images and shots, and it's this thing that just gives you this, like a little bit what we were talking about with Suspiria, a little bit, where it's just, you get these feelings. So it's like the beginning of the movie where Danny's brushing his teeth, and then we just cut to the blood elevator, and the music is just doing that kind of, the music in this movie is awesome, the old orchestral scores. But I love the bartender scene because it's the one scene where there's really a lot of dialogue.
Oh, sure.
And I just love, you could see Jack Nicholson go through the range of emotions from like, oh, I'm going to have a drink, to being super pissed. That whole thing about, like, I didn't mean to hurt the little fucker. He grabbed his arm and it fucked out of place. And that whole thing.
Just,
He knocked my pages over. And then going to the bathroom right after that and talking to Grady.
Mm-hmm. With that garish red and white bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Oof.
Yep. Yeah. What do we think of the weird, I'm going to only assume orgy, bear sequence, the bear doll?
Yeah, you know what's funny is I talked a little bit about that. That's detailed a lot in the book, or much more than on screen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I think in this film is just like, whoa, what the fuck is this? You know, kind of unsettling, right, and like upsetting. But it's also a little bit more traditional horror. And so it's more shock because, you know, she goes into that ball and it's all the skeletons and the cobwebs and the guy's got the knife in his head. And so I'm kind of like, oh, okay.
I think of the Haunted Mansion from Disneyland.
Yeah. It's like, okay, I see that this is more like traditional horror than it is creepy, I guess. So I don't know. I don't know if I like that as much.
I do like it, if only because I feel like it creates a history for the hotel that is unexplained. And I think also the way it's shot, like if it was done slowly, like if she was really looking at it and we looked at it for a long time, I think it's the fact that she runs by and then it's like just cut to a super close up and then cut away.
Okay.
Like while she's running. So it, like, adds this like, what the fuck? Cause it's, you know, with the 70s and the 80s, it's a thing where you have to remember that like, these movies were not on video. You know, you weren't going to pause and rewind it. Like, the only time you got to see these were in the theater with a crowd.
Yeah.
So it's like that kind of thing is everyone's just like, what the fuck, when that kind of stuff comes up. And you can't, like, pause it and rewind it and go, what the hell's that?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Because she just keeps running into rooms and, like, weird shit happens. And you're like, what is that now?
Yeah, I asked Eric. I was like, what was that all about? And he was like, well, you have to remember they're at, like, a New Year's Eve ball or something. And who knows what's going on? I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Furries were a thing back then.
You have to kill them all, Mr. Jones.
I guess.
Against you.
Go ahead, Cruz. Sorry.
So, like the picture at the end where he's in it.
Oh yes.
I mean, I don't. Is that just supposed to be another like what the fuck, or did someone explain that early on and I missed it?
You're always the caretaker.
I think, yeah, I think almost you could debatably say the idea I'm comfortable, it's unexplainable, really. Like, I can give any answer in the world, it's unexplainable. But I kind of like the idea that it's like, whoever dies in that hotel shows up in that photo eventually.
Mm. Oh, like maybe it was the first guy that went crazy was there.
And then, Grady.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could be. I like that. Yeah, okay. I like that explanation. I also wanted to say that, you know, we Cameron mentioned Scatman Crothers, but I think that the Dick O'Halloran, first of all, his hotel room is awesome, or his house, or whatever it is, with the naked ladies with the afro.
Just, like, right above the bed.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He knows what's up.
And so I really do like how Kubrick kind of sets you up for, he's going to go all this way, he's going through all this trouble, he's going to get there, he's going to save the day, and he completely undermines that.
It is the most anticlimactic everything he has to go through, but in a great way. It is such a wonderful movie version of like, fuck you, you thought the cavalry was coming, we blew it up.
Thing. But he did, I mean, like, he did bring the getaway car.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. He did win in the end.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, he brought the getaway car, but Jack Torrance died in the snow.
Yeah.
So he could have just hung out. I guess they could have just hung out in the hotel, right?
That's true. I do also love Jack Torrance is yelling in the maze. At first he's like, Jenny! And then by the end, he's like,
ugh! Yeah, right. Now,
funny story about that. We heard, here's another peek behind the curtain, but we went to Chicago for the Nebraska Northwestern football game this past Saturday, and we heard a lot of the, type stuff. Like, it was animalistic and guttural, and it was disturbing. There was a gentleman that was behind us that had drank way too much and had been on several pills or drugs.
He was jumping around like
he was running into pregnant ladies. He was a mess.
Oh.
It was like him and I started pushing each other, and it was like, I'm a very passive person. And it was like, if I'm saying fuck you, you fucking fuck, then I'm probably pretty upset. So it was quite, and right after.
Oh, you ready for some football?
Yeah. And right after it happened, I was like, oh my God, that dude sounds just like Torrance in The Shining. Like, he's unbelievable right now. So anyway.
Oh my God. Did you guys talk about how Stephen King, not a fan?
Yes. And Stephen Weber. Stephen Weber version.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of that.
Yeah.
All things equal, Mr. King. No, and here's the thing. It's one of those things. It's hard because, you know, there's so many articles out there about, like, you know, of all the Stephen King adaptations that are garbage, why does he hate this one? And I think that's one of those things where it's like you have to know Stephen King's history to some extent, like as a human being. And it's like this is like a super personal story for him.
Yeah.
Because he dealt with alcoholism and alcohol and substance abuse and all these other things and kept dealing with it after The Shining was published. But I think for him, this book was so much about like something taking you over and not being able to control it.
Mm-hmm.
And feeling like you're out of control.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Having no say over the things that are happening to you and how it affects your family and your children and all this other stuff. That it's almost like there's an external force. And it's a very personal human story. Kubrick is a very cold, calculating director with a distance to him.
Mm-hmm.
And King, I don't necessarily agree with this, but King's thought process is the fact that Kubrick as a man was a very outspoken atheist and didn't believe in the afterlife and ghosts and things of that nature. And Stephen King kind of basically said, like, it'd kind of be helpful if the person who made this movie did.
Mm. Hmm.
So maybe he didn't like him more personally than he didn't like the film?
Well, I don't think he likes his point of view.
The way it was projected.
Yeah, I think it's not so much like that Stephen King's a super religious person. If you read enough of his books, he really, you know, takes religious people across the coals as well. But I think for him, the idea of The Shining was supposed to be a more hopeful story that you're in the end that it's like, yes, Jack Torrance dies, but he dies fighting the hotel, as it were.
Mm.
And he saves his son. And so it's basically like giving yourself over to something and that there's maybe going to be something in the end. And that obviously The Shining has ghosts in it. And the sequel book that just came out last year.
Yeah. Dr. Sleep,
which is very good. I liked it quite a bit. Deals with an older Danny Torrance and that there is an afterlife, there is all this stuff. So I think from Stephen King's point of view, it's like you have to believe hopefully there's something at the end. And if you're a filmmaker who doesn't and the film is just like, yeah, he died in the snow, who cares?
Yeah.
So
That's interesting.
I love The Shining. But I understand like if you write a very personal story about like, this is my heart on my sleeve talking about my alcohol abuse. And then this filmmaker comes around and goes, I'm not interested in that. I'm just going to make a creepy hotel movie. You're probably like, fuck you, dude.
Right.
Yeah, I can see it.
Yeah.
It is. I would say that, you know, he is in the minority though. This is considered a, you know,
yes, of course. Of course.
This is considered a very good film. Do we have anything else?
I have one more thing. Has anyone seen Room 237, the documentary?
Oh, I talked about what a piece of shit that is, yeah.
Okay, good. I was going to say I'm in the minority of thinking that that movie's terrible.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm not a fan. Not a fan. The only one question that I guess I have that I haven't mentioned this, and Cameron, maybe you'll have an idea here, is how does Jack get out of the closet, out of that storeroom? Is it Grady that does it?
Yeah, I think that's the only thing that's sort of left unexplainable, because everything else you can say, you know, that's just Jack. He went crazy. He went crazy with cabin fever. But the fact that Wendy also sees things like the bear man and all that other stuff makes me go, yeah, okay, the ghosts have some external force.
Because I guess I always took it as she can see them, but they can't actually do anything to her. Like, they can't touch her. They can't interact physically was the way that I always took it, I guess.
Which I think can remain true because Jack is totally accepting of all of this.
Mm. Okay.
Again, it's an unexplainable thing. I can bullshit my way into it and being like, this is the answer I've made up that I like. But
yeah. That's kind of what I thought. He's like, are you going to be a pussy or what? And he's like, no, I'm not. And he's like, fine, click, click, open up.
I will say this usually doesn't tend to happen, but this movie is slightly affected by the fact that I cannot help but think of the Simpsons parody sometimes when I watch this.
Mm. Nice.
And it's the only movie that's affected that way, and that's probably because it's the best Simpsons Halloween episode.
There you go.
The Shining episode.
There you go. All right, do we have anything else about The Shining before we move on to Cameron's pick? No? All right, our next film is from 1981, the following year, and it is An American Werewolf in London.
This is the story of two young American students traveling through England on the night of the full moon.
Did you hear that?
I heard that.
What was it? It could be a lot of things.
Fate let one live.
That lunatic must have been a very fierce fellow.
Wasn't a lunatic.
What?
A wolf.
Oh, be serious, would you?
And now everything is changing. Changing. Changing.
Good Lord.
John Landis, the brilliant young director of Animal House and the Blues Brothers, has turned a classic tale of terror into something new. Something different.
Excuse me.
A naked American man stole my balloon.
I'm a werewolf.
An American Werewolf in London. Something different.
Two American college students are on a walking tour of Britain and are attacked by a werewolf. One is killed, the other is mauled. The werewolf is killed but reverts to its human form, and the local townspeople are unwilling to acknowledge its existence. The surviving student begins to have nightmares of hunting on 4 feet at first, but then finds that his friend and other recent victims appear to him, demanding that he commit suicide to release them from their curse, being trapped between worlds because of their unnatural deaths.
Thank you very much for finding that on your own, Cruz.
You're welcome.
That's like the first time in the 3 years of this show that I didn't put that in there.
I know, I was like, this, oh, okay, I got it.
I was like, wait a minute, it starts on Elm Street. That's not right.
It all starts on Elm Street.
Right?
As we'll soon find out. So, Cameron, this is your selection. What is it that you like so much about this film?
Ooh, when we did our special like a couple years ago on my show, I talked about how much I love vampire films, but like werewolf films are like my go-to almost. Which is funny to say because there's so many bad ones. Now there's a lot of bad vampire films, but werewolf movies sometimes. I'm hearing myself.
Me too.
Ooh.
Okay. How about that?
Just. We're good. With American Werewolf in London, like, so I love werewolf movies, and like, you know, the first horror movie I remember seeing is The Wolfman, the Lon Chaney Jr. One. Okay. So then growing up, there's always that hunt for a good werewolf movie. And there's a couple. This same year as this movie, The Howling came out. The Howling is a lot of fun. But I think this film interests me because, A, it's a horror comedy. It's a very funny movie.
Right. It's ridiculous.
It's a super funny movie. It's made by John Landis, written and directed by John Landis. John Landis, before this, did the Blues Brothers, Kentucky Fried Movie, and Animal House. And after this, did Coming to America and films like that.
Oh, Thriller.
Thriller? Yeah, Thriller was right after this. Obviously, this was the movie that inspired Michael Jackson to do Thriller.
Mm-hmm.
Not the album, but the music video as it is done. including the cat eyes at the very end. It's also interesting to me that, like, as someone who wants to go make movies, that Landis wrote this film when he was 19. Because he was a PA on a couple films, and he was in a foreign country. And he saw the idea for this movie came from the fact that he saw this burying ritual. And this person was buried feet down. And he asked, he's like, well, why do you bury them that way? This is culture. And they basically answered him and said, like, well, because if they wake up from the dead, they can't get out.
Mm.
But you can hear them. Like, their head is above the ground, but the rest of their body is buried. But you can hear them. So, like, if they weren't dead, they can shout, I'm not dead, from the ground. And to him, that just really caught him as, like, himself being an American in this foreign country and this ritual. And he was like, well, what's a ritualistic thing? And he kind of thought of the werewolves and all this other stuff. And he's like, what if you bring this American person to this foreign culture? Now, it's in London, so it's not that crazy foreign. But it's just this interesting kind of thing. And then these nightmare sequences and all this other stuff, the makeup effects by Rick Baker, the transformation sequence is a famous transformation sequence.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big thing for him, too, was Landis went into this movie talking about he wanted to film werewolves transformations, A, in a completely different way, B, see it all on camera, because oftentimes, obviously, werewolf transformations tend to happen where it's like the person's screaming and then you cut to a shadow, or a dissolve effect, or the camera will go around and the camera will suddenly end up behind a couch and suddenly we're at a new cut and the person's more transformed. He didn't want to do that, and he also wanted to film it all in the brightest light possible.
And it wasn't, and they had a big disagreement because it wasn't as long as Baker wanted, right?
Correct. Yep. So yeah, and that this movie, unlike a lot of other 80s films that are comedic, this is a horror comedy. It airs on, when I was growing up, it aired on Comedy Central all the time.
Weird.
Really?
Yeah, it aired on Comedy Central way more than like Sci-Fi Channel or things that showed horror movies. This was far more on Comedy Central. It has a sad ending.
Yeah, it has an Eric Williams style ending.
Like
everybody dead.
Pretty much. Yeah, he is not he's not cured. There's no, unlike the terrible American Werewolf in Paris, which is no one associated with this film helped that movie. It's just kind of, it takes a similar story and sets him in Paris. There's like, oh, you can be cured if you do this, and they're all cured.
Hmm.
This Yikes. Movie's like,
oh yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah, this movie's like, no. So yeah, I love the soundtrack. I love the soundtrack has all these different moon songs.
Oh yeah, every song has the moon in the title, right?
Yep. And I love the scene in the beginning with the bar.
Mm.
That big bar.
Well, just the whole banter between him and his friend, like even when his friend is dead, they're like still giving each other shit.
Yeah, you know what? Watching this, I was like, oh, Cruz is going to love that.
Yep. Cruz did.
Yeah, so Rachel, this was the first watch for you. So what did you think of this?
I did like the transformation scenes. Like, I think the bones clicking was like kind of, I mean, like as realistic as you can be watching someone turn into a werewolf. But I was like, oh my God, there's like cracking and clicking and it's like, ooh, Jesus. And so I liked that a lot better than Teen Wolf. And I liked them giving each other shit. And I thought, you know, like, I didn't know this was a comedy. And so I'm watching the beginning. I'm like, oh, that's fun. They're like friends and they're just hanging out. And then I'm like, okay, now we're going to get all serious. But then his friend shows up later and he's like still being ridiculous. And I'm like, okay, well, I can also appreciate that. You know, and it's just kind of weird because like has these like moments of being horribly scared and then he's like kind of being kooky a little bit. And so like he's kind of taking it pretty well that he's a werewolf for a while. And then like you said, it's not like a super far cry from American, you know, they're in London, but, you know, it's not like he's, like, trying to tell the cops he's a werewolf in French or anything, so, but they still don't arrest him. But that part I was, like, I was just kind of weird. So, like, the people that have to die, like, even if he doesn't kill himself, he dies at the end, so they're all free? Is that how that works?
Yeah, anyone that he's killed, as soon as he dies, yeah.
Okay, so he doesn't have to kill himself, he just has to die.
I believe that's right.
And then they're all free.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess that was just my other question. At the end, I was like, okay, well, that's really sad, but like, okay, I didn't get an epilogue, I guess?
Yeah, you didn't get the ghost going away into the
right, ends. Like, oh, thank you for dying. Like, that would have been cool.
It wasn't straight from Ghost, like you were hoping?
Right, like his friend didn't get like an awesome catchphrase right before the end or anything, so...
Hey, that's not shit on Ghost.
I would have appreciated that.
And now, this was a first watch for Strauss as well. What did you make of this?
It was nice because we watched it one night, had a little bit too much to drink, and then watched it again, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, we watched it one night, and we're like, holy shit, look at those notes. Like, they that doesn't like, make...
sideways.
Yeah, it was like, I can't even make...
Can't even read them.
Yeah, I can't make sense.
I can see the werewolf's butt.
Werewolf man.
I got the love the, and then I don't know what the word is. I've got shit going down the side of the page. I don't know what it is.
Well, I liked it. Funny. It was fun. I guess I also didn't know it was a comedy at first. So I was, like, expecting it to be super scary. So when the parts did get, like, a little bit thriller-esque. I was like, huh? And then it was funny. I liked how at the end he gets the hot nurse, and then they fall in love after, like, one night of hot sex. And
well,
they love each other.
Yeah, debatably hot sex, because didn't we both write that that was not a particularly steamy love scene between the two actors, though?
That's true.
It's the 80s. It's the 80s. Take that for people to fall in love in 80s movies.
Yeah. So I thought that was good.
Yeah, I had seen this before as well, but I thought that, it's a film where I watch it and I forget how comedic it is.
Yeah.
Because that opening scene is fun, you know, and it's funny, and they're talking about the guy that, you know, wants to nail the girl with a good body. And, boy, Jack is really fucking killed good. Like, when he's killed, like, that is some grisly shit.
It is. Yeah. I think what I like about this movie is that it is a comedy director. I mean, John Landis is a comedy guy, but there are very visceral things in this film.
Mm-hmm.
When Jack gets tackled by the wolf and... David Naughton's character is just running at top speed away.
Pussy.
Like,
and
as
then
if, like.
He turns around.
Yeah.
And he turns around, but it's like, it's almost like fight or flight. It feels very real. Like, yeah. As movie-esque as this movie is, that feels very real. Like, something comes out and you just book it. You're not even thinking about who you're with or anything.
Right.
And then you calm down for a minute and you're like, oh my God, you turn around and try to go get your friend. And I really like the werewolf howl in this film.
Mm.
It's a weird thing to point out, but it's like a mixture of like a howl and a scream.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Something similar to that, Cameron. I like that this is more than just a horror film.
Yes, but the horror scenes are like the train sequence, the train.
Oh, the subway stuff. Yeah.
And the fact that the werewolf, obviously,
oh, yeah.
Once he's a full on wolf, it's pretty much, if you look at, you know, look up photos and stuff like that, it's pretty much just the top half of a thing. Like, there's no back half. That's all the electronics and stuff like that. And then it shows the artistry of directing it so you wouldn't know that. So, like, the shot at the top of the stairway where you just see the wolf walking up slowly to the guy who's lying there.
Oh, yeah.
Is super creepy and super well done. But also knowing what you have as far as, like, your special effects.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, we don't have back legs. We have no back half to this creature. So film it like this and film it like that.
Yeah. I like that because I think that you have to be more resourceful when, you know, and you're forced into certain shots to where now it's easier and maybe, you know, debatably lazier just to say, oh, it's CGI, they'll just fix it, whatever. We can make whatever shot we want it to look. We can look however we want it to look.
And then you are forced into certain shots because you have no back half of this thing. So, like, the end sequence where this creature's running around like Piccadilly Circus, and it's just, like, the top half of its body – to make it look like it's attacking people, people have to run right next to this thing and, like, have their legs, like, clip its face.
Mm.
Which is great. So while you're watching it, you're like, oh, shit, he's going to bite somebody. They're right there. As opposed to if you had a whole figure body thing and you filmed it from 20 feet away.
Yeah.
But because you have to get right there next to it, people have to run into it and all this other stuff, so it makes it more visceral.
That's true, yeah.
Hmm. I like that. One of the things that I liked about just the character as, he turns into a wolf, but I love that he's still kind of an American asshole.
Right. Oh, totally.
You know, I like that he's not like a humble, like, oh man, I don't know what's going on. Can someone help me? He's like, yeah, fuck you. Like, I'm from the U.S. of A, goddammit.
Yep.
You know?
America.
Yeah. He's just like that kind of a jerk off, but not so much to where you don't like him. He's just like, oh, come on, guy. Like, make it a little easier on yourself, why don't you?
I do love the other asshole American, though, from the embassy that's like, I appreciate the fact that you're upset, but you're making a scene.
Oh, Frank Oz? Is that what you're talking about? In the
in the hospital?
In the hospital, yeah. I was like, oh, it's Miss Piggy, holy shit.
I thought he was a bad guy.
Well.
He's an American bureaucrat.
I mean, like, he's a dick, but I thought that he had, like, something, really.
Like another plot?
I don't know, I thought he had, like, yeah, I thought he had, like, more grisly intentions or something, but he just turned out to be a dumbass.
Like, he was gonna take him and feed him to the werewolf or something?
Like, there's gonna be something with
Frank Oz. Yeah, or, like, it was, like, a hostile thing where he was, like, bringing Americans to London to get turned into werewolves. I don't really know what was
going on. Yeah, I haven't seen that. So, So, Cameron, let me ask you this. If you ever go to London, would you ever go to a place called the Slaughtered Anything?
Oh, yeah.
Without hesitation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no question.
I live like 10 blocks from Hollywood. You know how many crazy bar names there are?
Yeah, I suppose. In the Midwest, that is not the case.
I love the bar sequence when it's like that whole room is like talking and everyone's getting along. And he's like, what's with the pentagram? So it's like you see like Jack want, like he's constantly about to say something.
Mm-hmm.
And as everyone's laughing, he's like, what's with the pentagram on the wall?
Right. And then like you can hear the record go, it's like basically, and everyone's like, who the fuck is this guy?
Yeah, I was like, what? Why the fuck did he say that?
Yeah, what are you doing, Jack?
What a dummy.
Mm.
But I can say, for myself, I've been in, like, a similar situation where it's like, let's say you go to a party and it's like someone breaks up. And you want to be like, what happened? How did they break up? And everyone's talking to be like, what happened to Justin?
Oh, my God.
I like that. Oh, that's good.
What do we think of the dream sequences?
Oh, I was just gonna mention that. I was like, Cameron, you have to have loved the dream sequences, right?
Oh, with the Nazi bear people.
Yeah,
whatever they are.
The Nazi monsters, the nightmare thing. The nightmare and the nightmare got me again this time. You know, it's like where it's the shock inside the shock. And I feel,
yeah, that got me too.
Yeah, I feel like we see that more often now, but on a film, you know, that's came out in 1981, it was a little bit more surprising to me, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
I love him being in the, like, his dream where he's nude in the woods and then sees himself in the bed.
Yeah, now that's interesting. Like, you know, that was, I was watching that going, what the hell is this? Like, that was one of the things I didn't necessarily remember that well about the film, was all of the him being naked in the woods in the dreams. Cause I was like, okay, well, he's naked, right? And he's running around naked in London. I remember
primal.
That. That was
primal.
Like, but I was like, man, the dream stuff, I didn't remember it as well, I guess.
Because
it's been a while
though,
since I'd seen this.
Yeah.
Plus, yeah, you're drunk.
I like his friend keeps getting grosser every time he's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, rotting more
he's
and
like,
more.
I'm really.
And,
yeah, I like that.
I don't think we could wrap the discussion up of this one without mentioning the porn house that they're in, right? Like, what a scene, what a setting.
Mostly because of the usher or whoever will not leave.
Yes!
Yeah, I don't know if I like that, but I think that's interesting.
Right. Like, first of all, like, how low do you have to be an usher there? And then, like, if somebody was doing something, I'd be like, not my problem. I'm not gonna go talk to this dude.
If somebody was getting all sweaty, rocking a chair back and forth, going like, ugh, get out of here.
Yep. I don't think I would be anywhere in the vicinity.
I wouldn't want to see that.
Yeah.
I will say that's what's interesting about the two different transformations is like the second time it's like it's ramping up and he almost like he feels it and he's getting hot and everything. The first one I love the fact that he's just reading a book and suddenly just like freaks out.
Mm.
Which I think makes it more frightening. Like, it's not like a buildup. It's not like he's getting hot and all this other stuff and he's walking around the room. He's just reading a book and suddenly just, oh, God!
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like the Hulk. It's not like he's like, oh, man, now you pissed me off and now you're going to get it. Here comes the werewolf.
I love him waking up naked in the zoo.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Real zoo, right? And just got put in there.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I have no idea. His girlfriend seems to be like okay with it now that he's home.
Yeah, she's she's an interesting character because she's pretty horny for it like the whole time.
Yeah, she likes an American guy.
Yeah,
to the point where she's like overlooking like the fact that he shows up naked and like weird at her apartment.
Yeah.
That's what she likes. He's an animalistic American.
That's right.
I guess.
You can't tell me that early on in your relationship that if Brad showed up naked somewhere, you'd be like, well, whatever.
Well, now he's like, hey, you want to go, you know, to the races? I won't wear any clothes. I mean, like, that's just romantic, really.
You guys should all go to a football game together.
There you go. We could see Jack Torrance's substitute. It'd be a thing. There you go. Well, do you guys have anything else about this one before we move on to our last film?
I'd kind of like to briefly talk about John Landis a little bit.
Oh, sure.
An interesting dude.
That horrible accident.
It's a horrible accident on the set of the Twilight Zone movie where a man got killed and two children. And a lot of people think that that's sort of what killed his career. But if you look at that timeline-wise, that came out before Coming to America.
Yeah, and Coming to America is fucking great. So
yeah,
and it was a massive hit. It was huge. But yeah, John Landis is an interesting guy. Many of these directors we're talking about, except for the guy we're going to talk about next, many horror movie directors did not do well in the 90s. John Landis is one of those guys. He put out a couple of movies. You know, I'm not saying they were good and therefore misunderstood, like they weren't very good movies, but John Landis, John Carpenter, a lot of these big horror movie directors, when the 90s came around, they did not continue to have great success.
Why do you think that is?
I think, in truth, I think it's because it sounds so silly, but, you know, people often talk about the 90s as being like a very PC age.
Yeah.
And if you look, unless you were, you know, a Steven Spielberg who put out, you know, Jurassic Park, and it's actually even worth noting, in the early 90s, before Jurassic Park, a lot of people started to write off Spielberg.
Mm.
Because in the late 80s, Always didn't do very well, Hook didn't do very well, you know, and those are, despite what we think of those movies.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't bring up Hook. We'll get a Cruise fight.
No. I like Hook.
No,
if Cruise
likes
Hook, we would
agree.
Good.
Thank you, Cameron. Wrong. It's not Thank you, good. Cameron.
But that's not my point. My point is that they did. We're gonna have a. It was great. My point being is that those movies didn't do well and they weren't looked upon critically. And then he did Jurassic Park. Wes Craven did Scream, and I wonder if like those two movies had not been what they did, would those two directors also be like people who got lost in the 90s? Because I think like yeah, outside of like doing a big blockbuster like Jurassic Park or independent films like a Quentin Tarantino and Soderbergh and Kevin Smith, these guys that came up in independence, everything else, the kind of mid-tier, not super expensive films, which are horror movies, weren't really being made.
Hmm.
People were not really interested in making those kinds of movies because also they're R-rated. Like most of the action films, unless you did like Die Hard 3, like action sequels, most action films came out were PG-13.
Oh.
Bunch of pussies in the 90s.
Right.
Well, even like, but even like, you know, we talked about it a little bit in the James Bond episode, like, did we ever want to do Pierce Brosnan? And my answer was no. because they're very boring. Like, they're very squeaky clean. And I think that's the thing. It's like, horror movies are not squeaky clean, but like, they're violent, they're exploitative, they're often misogynistic or homophobic or, you know, all these other things that I'm not saying are necessarily good things, but a studio in the 90s was not interested in backing those projects.
Well, yeah, I remember. I know I'm a lot younger than most here, but...
Nope, I think you and I are the same age.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice. Go team.
'05!
But I just remember watching movies with my parents, and they were like, it's an R movie. Just like R being like...
This huge stigma.
So bad, even though they still let me watch them, and I shouldn't have. But like, yeah, I just remember R being such a bad thing, and nowadays it's like, oh, it's R, whatever. Like, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, well... You know, also in the 90s, didn't we have just some shitty retreads of sequels? You know, because we have our Nightmare on Elm Street sequels, we have our Halloween sequels,
all
we have
the ones
our,
that I saw.
Yeah, we have our Friday the 13th sequels. Like all of those were
not too much because those were all pretty much in the 80s. Those were the late 80s.
Really, we didn't get any of those in the early 90s.
Nightmare 7, which is good, is 94. Jason Goes to Hell is 91.
What about Halloween H2O?
When Halloween sequels are, well, actually, I think it's only H2O is in the 90s.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Curse of Michael Myers 5 is 94. So you get two of them. And Curse of Michael Myers, and Halloween H2O is not that great either. Sorry, everybody. It's not. I know your memories are sweet, but not good.
Josh Hartnett. He's a horrible actor.
Michael Myers? Yeah.
No. Josh Hartnett? Isn't he in that?
Oh, yeah. He's okay.
Yeah.
He's completely disappeared, Josh Hartnett.
Nope.
He's on Sin City.
He's on Penny Dreadful, the Showtime show that with Eva Green that is awesome.
Oh, okay. Never seen it.
Boom. There you go.
Knowledge bomb right there. All right.
That's the interesting thing about John Landis to me is that his career kind of went in the 90s. And a lot of people like to look back and go like, because the Twilight Zone movie, and it's like, no, it's because he made genre films.
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't know. I mean, he's still around. It's not like he's dead.
No, he's still around, but he mostly appears like on DVD special features for like anytime they re-release the Wolfman.
Yeah, like when we you watch your 100 scariest movie moments from Bravo that came out, you know what, like 10 years ago or so. And
well, he did, along with Carpenter and a bunch of other, Toby Hooper and a bunch of other directors, did the TV series Masters of Fear.
Yeah, right.
He directed a bunch of those. So a lot of these guys either went into TV or took a lot of time off.
It's too bad.
You would think the next director.
Yeah, you would think that, maybe there's room for them in the post-Saw, like, horror renaissance.
Well, what you're finding now...
Sure.
This is a totally different discussion. What you're finding now is a lot of great directors who are younger coming up who are fans of those guys and super inspired by them.
Yeah.
But I think, like, John Carpenter, I think, is kind of disillusionized with the industry. Pretty much, if you read an interview with John Carpenter, he really just wants to talk about video games and talk about basketball. and also, like, a lot of these guys are in their 70s, so how passionate are they going to be about making teenagers get killed violent films?
Yeah.
What if we did a whole thing on Saw?
Oh, no way.
How would that come out?
I would do it.
Just a lot of, so that part made my stomach hurt, and that was disgusting.
Yeah.
I already got my tickets to go see the re-release.
Your tickets to see the re-release?
Yeah, the re-release in the first one in theaters on Halloween Day.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Dang.
Better believe I'm going.
That must be an L.A. thing.
Yeah.
Right.
That's not
happening here.
Yeah, that's not a Lincoln, Nebraska thing.
Yeah.
To the best of my knowledge. All right, well, let's move on to my selection, which of course means it's the best film, right?
Right.
God. Anyway, it's
the next...
It's the 1984 film, A Nightmare on Elm Street.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
We just see cuts happen.
What did that, Lieutenant?
I don't know.
Peter!
The coroner got to say. In the jaw and puking since he saw it.
They're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy?
There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't...
No!
She's the only one who can stop it. If she fails,
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy.
No one will survive.
Help me, please!
Who are you?
From Wes Craven, director of The Hills Have Eyes and Last House on the Left, a new masterpiece in fantasy terror, Nightmare on Elm Street.
On Elm Street, Nancy Thompson and a group of her friends, including Tina Gray, Rod Lane, and Glenn Lance, are being tormented by a clawed killer in their dreams named Freddy Krueger. Nancy must think quickly as Freddy tries to pick off his victims one by one. When he has you in your sleep, who is there to save you?
Now what a terrifying premise, right? You fall asleep and you you don't wake up dead. You end up dying in your sleep. You end up being murdered in your dreams. And my history with this, and the reason that I picked it, was I saw this on VHS. I saw this at my cousin's house, and I saw this fairly soon after it had been released. So 85-ish, and I was born in 79, in late 79, so I was, 5-6 years old watching A Nightmare on Elm Street, and it freaked me the fuck out, to where I didn't watch any of the sequels till probably I was like 16 or 17. I used to have Nightmares about Freddy Krueger. It's not like I like the films now and I can kind of look at, you know, look at them for what they are and how silly they can be at times and that sort of thing. But if I see, that sort of look, the hat and the sweater and the claw fingers and all of that, that is definitely a thing in Halloween I will not be looking forward to when Strauss and I go hang out with at the gay club. You know, that's not a look that I'm going to be looking for, so to speak. Like, that's the thing where it'll still freak me out.
What if I dress
What will you be looking for in the gay club?
I'll be looking for a lot of things, mostly good dancers.
What if I were to dress
That's a really good question, Cameron.
Yeah, I'll be looking for mostly good dancers, nice abs. If Strauss dressed up like that, I would probably want to go far away from her. if she put on, like, the fucked up face, I don't know if I'd like that so much.
Oh, God, that's
But anyway, so I really like this film. I think that it is, you know, Cameron wanted us to watch Nightmare 3, which Nell and I did, and I think that this film is much different than that one. It's much more of a different Freddy Krueger, and so I think that just speaking about this one right now, I think that it's a quality horror film. And, you know, looking at it now, you can see why there's been so many sequels and why it was, you know, turned into a franchise. And it was one that I, you know, still think is scary. Like the Tina death, I still think is a scary thing.
Which one is that?
It's the first one with her on the ceiling and stuff.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, it's definitely one that I am glad that we watched. So, so Cameron, why don't you go next? What do you think of A Nightmare on Elm Street? This film in general, before getting into the sequels. Do you have 20 minutes?
Yeah,
like your first kiss, you never forget. Your first horror icon. when I was
I was taking a drink. I was trying not to spill wine all over the place.
when I was about 5 or 6, I went to a friend's house, and Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2 was on. Not Part 1, Part 2. And Part 2, looking at it, it's a very weird film. But there's a sequence in there where Freddy Krueger, where the kid transforms into Freddy Krueger. Mm. And it's a very violent sequence where and now you can look at it and you totally see what's the puppet and what's this and what's that. But at 6 years old, it looks so real that it's like, this kid gets the glove hand and rips his stomach open and Freddy comes out and it's this whole thing. And it's just like, oh my God. so at 6 years old, that fucked up my world. And so of course I had to see the rest. And actually then later on in life, the first DVDs I bought, the very first one was the Nightmare on Elm Street box set. Was that big brown box set. Yeah, Freddy Krueger to me, you know, like I can sit back and honestly say as a film fan that Halloween is a better film. It's artistically made. And there's all that to it, but that character, the Freddy Krueger iconic character, is such he's an icon, I think, because of his attitude and who he is. And he's the first killer that enjoys what he does. And the only, you know, even after that, there were still so many slasher movies, slasher killers, things like that, where the person was just kind of like a Jason or a Michael that had a mask and they were silent. The only other character that kind of took on the Freddy Krueger persona of like, I'm going to tease you as I kill you was Chucky.
Oh, sure.
Like this talkative person that laughed and enjoyed what they did. And
Leprechaun.
I think, oh, that's true. How could I have forgotten the Leprechaun?
The Jennifer Aniston performance alone.
Especially right? When he goes to Vegas in Part 3. It's also I think that like the culture, you know, pop culture, and I'm a big pop culture person. I love looking back at like things that people embrace. Like the fact that Crocodile Dundee was the number one movie that year came out is fascinating to me. And I want to, you know, like almost like pop cultural anthropology. I want to be like, what happened? Like, what was going on?
That's not a knife, Cameron. This is a knife.
Man, that's a knife.
Deborah. I think so. Freddy Krueger as a cultural figure just fascinates me that it's like he kind of got embraced by at the same time this movie came out the same year MTV started. I think 84 or maybe MTV started in 81. But either way, it's right around the same time. And, you know, in part three, part five, all the other Freddy Krueger movies, there's like a heavy metal song done by a famous MTV artist at the time. He became like something kids enjoyed, like there was Freddy Krueger dolls and all this other stuff. And what's interesting about that too is when you think about the fact that culturally he was hugely accepted. People loved this Freddy Krueger character. He even got a TV show, Freddy's Nightmares.
Nice.
And stuff like that. The fact that it was a movie no one wanted to make.
Interesting.
Wes Craven went to every major studio and he got the same note over and over again, which was, this isn't scary, it's dreams. Everyone's going to know it's fake.
What?
And
well, I bet all the people that turned him down feel real bad about that now.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and he ended up going to New Line Cinema because of Sean Cunningham. Sean Cunningham, who had made Friday the 13th, he was the first director of Friday the 13th. Together, him and Wes Craven made the Last House on the Left.
Oh, and that's a fucked up movie.
Oh, very fucked up. together, and Sean Cunningham was like, well, why don't you talk to these guys at New Line? New Line, at that point, had not really made any movies. They were a distribution company.
Mm.
They were like, yeah, you know, we'll find films and try and help put them out. And they wanted to get into the movie making business. And Nightmare on Elm Street was the one they put all their chips down on. They to film it, they couldn't pay the crew for like a week or two as they tried to hustle around and get money. There's so many just fascinating things about the making of this movie and the fact that it's not an expensive film, but all the effects, I think, for me, still work. The Tina death, the Trundle room, the bed sequence and all that stuff. When you take into account, this was a movie made by no studio wanted to make it. The studio that did make it had never made a movie before. And 2 years later, he's the most popular pop culture horror character in the world.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Cruz, what did you make of it? Had you seen this before and what did you make of it?
No, I'd never seen this before.
Oh my God, Rachel, 0-3 today.
I told you when I was little, I didn't watch horror movies. Did we not go over this?
Yeah, I was a sheltered
child. I'm sure that if any of my sisters have seen this, I haven't watched it with them, obviously, and I highly doubt that either of them have seen this movie either.
So what did you think of it?
Well, you know, watching it when you're six and watching it now is probably a different thing. Cause I remember watching one of the, Jason movies at like one of my friend's houses when I was little. And I remember being a lot more scared of it, you know, cause you're a freaking little kid. So I wasn't really super scared of this movie.
Interesting. I did share with Cameron that you were scared to watch this movie. You were a little apprehensive about this film.
Yeah, because you're like, oh, it's about dreams, and like, I have really weird dreams anyway, and so I was like, oh, I don't know.
Which dream got you more, this one or the one in American Werewolf in London?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I liked a lot about it. I thought that some parts were totally 80s, but almost every movie in the 80s was totally 80s, and that's just what they did. Mm-hmm. Like some of the scary scenes for me, I kept thinking like the music. I'm like, this sounds like a Michael Jackson, like Thriller kind of song that's going on. So it like kind of took away from me being scared, I guess.
Go ahead, Cruz, sorry.
And also I think like kind of what you said that Freddy Krueger, he's like such a pop culture icon that like this wasn't just like a, you know, like a really creepy guy for me. I'm like, oh, that's what he looks like. You know, like, oh, that's that, you know, cause I'd never seen him in a movie. And so I'm like, oh, that's, you know, like what? So I'm watching it after the fact, you know, is kind of a dumb thing to do, but I did it anyway. That having been said, I did have some headphones in and I turned around a couple times cause I thought someone was coming up behind me. So.
Nice.
But, Yeah, and I thought the blonde girl death was really fucked up. I was like, oh yeah, that's still good. Johnny Depp sinking into the bed for me was a little like, oh, okay. But the blood afterwards, I was like, nice. So I guess it just depends that like most of it worked for me. A couple of things I was like, okay. But, for the most part, I enjoyed watching it, I guess. You can enjoy watching a horror movie, right?
Oh, absolutely you can. Yeah.
Okay.
I hope so. Otherwise, my October's been a waste.
All right. So, Strauss, have you seen this before?
No, I hadn't seen any of these movies before.
Okay. And we
me neither.
Yeah. And
so
we watched
it, both of you.
And we watched the first.
Hey, whoa, with both of you. I didn't say anything.
Thank you. Sorry, Cameron.
Yeah, we watched the first one and the third one. So what did you think of this one, Strauss?
I was a little bit more scared than Cruz was.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it in its 80s in entirety.
Its 80s-ness?
80s-ness, yeah. I love the first death. It was super dramatic.
Yeah, and you really liked the origin too, like the whole beginning to where it just kind of threw you in, right?
Yeah, I liked how when you the movie starts and it's just like horror film. There's no backstory. There's nothing. Like, she's literally in the dream as soon as the movie starts. I really, really like that.
Yeah, and now, you know, this one she had said, and you know, I am speaking for her here, but she had said that she liked that this one was a horror film right from the get-go. It wasn't trying to be more than that. It wasn't trying to be like a film, like a movie, like The Shining and American Werewolf in London. This was a horror film. It knows what it is, and that's exactly what it's going for. It's not trying to be anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I liked that too, that it just like right at the beginning was at the jugular. So. Mm-hmm.
And the horror
stuff is really kind of horrific. I think that's the other thing too. And what makes it stick is the fact that like he's laughing as he's doing it. It's like when he slices his fingers off.
Yeah, I feel like that's what was scarier for me. Cause he was enjoying it. He wasn't silent like in Halloween or, you know, I mean, I guess the werewolf, of course he's being loud or whatever, but. I liked in the third one where they start having little quirky things that he says.
Oh, he has little one-liners. Puns and.
I got a whole thoughts on the third one. Whole thoughts.
Okay, well, we'll stay on the first one. The first one, it generally scared me, and I was happy I saw it more as an adult, because if I would have saw this one as a younger person, it would have scared me a lot more. Like, I can still go to bed and be okay.
Yeah, I think it's funny that, you know. One of the things that, you know, people that know me know that I can fall asleep within probably a minute. Like I fall asleep so easily. So the threat of not being able to fall asleep is something that is very real to me. Like, holy shit, I can't fall asleep. What a terrible life that would be.
Oh, I love sleep so much. I would be doing what I think it's in the third one. She's eating instant coffee and slamming it with Diet Coke. And I was like, yes, that's what I would fucking do in a minute. I would just be like chewing coffee beans to not fall asleep.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that's also interesting about this film is also like how much of this like Wes Craven mixed in a bunch of different things. He talks about like that Fred, the name Krueger was, there was a kid who was a bully at school who beat him up. His name was Fred Krueger. So he's like, I'm going to name the child killer Fred Krueger.
Nice.
The ultimate revenge.
Oh, that's nice.
That's a good backstory. I like that.
So if there's a story when Rachel Cruz is the antagonist, we'll know why.
The child murderer.
Damn
Rachel
it.
Cruz. the look of Freddy was based off this drunk person, that drunk, possibly homeless old man that scared Wes Craven when he was a child with the fedora and everything. The sweater, the two colors of the sweater, Wes Craven had read a psychological magazine and said that specific red and specific green, the eyes have trouble putting those two colors together. It almost like automatically irritates you.
Mm. Funny because it's, you know, it's traditional Christmas colors.
No,
too.
It's for
right.
People that also that are colorblind.
Yeah, that's blue green.
Is it blue green?
I think so.
Yeah.
No, that's red and green and brown.
Yes.
Yeah. And he's burnt, so he's brown. So it's that three-way combo.
You guys don't know shit.
The hand knife, he said, was like, his inspiration was like, it's such a, like the first weapons man created were like these stabbing weapons. And he's like, well, everyone has already done the butcher knife or the axe. So he was like, wouldn't it be weird if a guy made his own weapon and that's where the hand blades come from?
Yeah, that part was super creepy, watching him make his own.
In the beginning of the movie, yeah.
Yeah, the worst part about it is not only it's not just like it's a knife on his hand. He's got like the springs. He's got like the whole deal that he's created in the
and
glove.
And he scrapes it against metal.
Yeah, that's the part where I'm like, shit. He's like taking the time to make sure this
and
is
the
like
taunting.
It's like a functioning thing.
Yeah.
He's basically like making knuckles for it, you know.
And then the big final thing was how people died in their sleep. There was a series of articles in the LA Times in the early 80s about people who were coming to America. A lot of young Asian men who had suffered through the Khmer Rouge were coming to America. This was in Los Angeles, and it's actually called like Asian death syndrome, where people were just dying in their sleep. And there was a specific story about a young man who was worried he was going to die if he went to sleep. And his parents tried to get him checked out, and they gave him sleeping pills, and they found the pills after he passed away. They found the pills in his room, like he'd never taken them. They found that he'd hidden a coffee pot, which is what he then has Heather Langenkamp, his character, do. So he took all these different inspirations and all these things and melted it together into this, like, creation.
And why would they die in their sleep?
Interesting.
It's unknown. Like, it's pretty much just, like, it seems to be some kind of weird traumatic. Like, it's never clearly been solved.
Something that they went through traumatically, and then, like, maybe they were at peace sleeping and just died?
Like, their nightmares, like, gave them heart attacks or something like that.
Oh.
Something creepy. Like, and they were young men. It wasn't like these were old people. And the one interesting thing, too, is, like, Wes Craven got what he wanted and all that. The one thing he wanted to do was cast an older actor. And then I think you have to talk about Robert Englund as Kruger. When Robert Englund came in, at this point, I think he was in maybe at his late 30s. Young guy, blonde hair, blue eyes, and Wes Craven was like, I don't think this is the guy. But Robert Englund, at that point, his big claim to fame was he was in the miniseries V. The Alien.
They tried to remake with Elizabeth Mitchell.
Yeah. And he kind of became the breakout star from that. And Wes Craven was kind of like, this guy's too young and this, that, and the other. But the thing Robert Englund was able to do is sort of embrace the evilness and the joy that Freddy Krueger has. And a lot of other actors who I guess came in and auditioned were not willing to do that.
Really?
And that kind of gave him the job. And the funny thing is, so many of Freddy's memorable lines and things that he does both in this film and in the later sequels are Robert Englund improvs. Like when Tina says, "Please God," and he brings the knife to his hand, a knife to his face, and goes, "This is God." That was an improv on the set.
Nice. I love that. I am such a fan of improv.
Yeah. and now apparently needs to move to LA.
Apparently.
She loves the improv.
And then like the scene when Nancy first is in the dream, and then Freddy starts, like, licking his tongue at her, like, licking it back and forth. That was something Englund did right there on the spot. And that's something gross. That's interesting about the Freddy Krueger character, and this is why Part 2 doesn't work, is Part 2 has a male protagonist. But there is something about this character that it's, like, it's never said. It's never outwardly said. And he doesn't sexually molest any of the
women.
That
he's a giant pervert? Yeah.
But he's, like, a pervert, and there is kind of this, like, he's breaking into not just your bedroom, but he's breaking into young girls' dreams.
There's
the bathtub scene where his most famous, hand's like in the middle of her crotch.
Yeah, the most famous sequence is the bathroom sequence, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's so it's all the stuff that's either, I mean, that's not a hint, but it's like nothing is done. Like the most overt sexual thing he does is when he goes, "I'm your boyfriend now," and the tongue comes out of the phone.
Yeah.
Like, other than that, there's always, like, this hint. It's, like, this layer of it that's never spoken of. And the other thing I think that makes this movie interesting, and I think the reason, on top of all the special effects and everything like that, is that Wes Craven used to be an English professor before he became a filmmaker.
Nice.
And when you watch him, I've told you this before, Eric, sometimes when you watch him do interviews, no matter how schlocky the movie he's made is, he will come up with some bullshit about some deeper meaning.
It's the quest of the inner man's struggle against himself, and you know, yeah.
But this film,
yeah,
but sometimes
the daily,
the daily. Sometimes though, he'll make certain films, and I think he's right on the money. And with this film, he kind of captures divorce culture.
Oh, interesting.
Which was very big in the 80s. I remember when you guys talked about E.T. Like last month, and you were kind of like, what was up with the mom? like about her kind of being absentee and all that stuff.
Yeah, she just did not, yeah.
That was something that was big in 80s movies was, Eric, you and I just watched The Exorcist. That's the only horror film I can think of in the 70s or general film where there's a divorcee. Mm.
Yeah.
For the most part, horror films dealt with parents. If the movie was about kids, either A, not at all, like, Friday the 13th where they're obviously all at camp, or Halloween where it's like, my parents are out for the night. Or there's like, my parents are fighting, but they don't believe me in this, that, and the other. But this movie, E.T., and a lot of other 80s movies were like, no, parents are divorced. And
so her parents were divorced?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, and I wrote a lot about that, about the mother being an alcoholic. And yeah, and because the dad was the cop. And
the dad isn't the cop, and, you know, they seemingly both are like, we did what we had to do to protect you. But in that way, it's like, father knows best, mother knows best. We do what we're doing what we do to need to protect you. At the same time, thus endangering their kids by putting the bars on the windows and doing all this other stuff. So it's this interesting thing of simultaneously helicopter parenting and yet at the same time pushing your kids into the danger.
And what a terrible mother she is. I mean, just whoring it up. I mean, come on.
Whoring it up?
Well, yeah, when she's got the guy at home and
you thinking about Part 3?
Oh, yeah, oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
I was like,
watched these really close together, so that
Jesus,
was part
of it. Like, Jesus Christ, some woman has a bottle of vodka, and Eric has just editorialized this whole person's life.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Foolish.
Vodka is her man, okay?
Yeah, if that was the case, I'd be quite the hypocrite.
Yeah, Jesus. and I think that's fascinating that, like, there is this whole divorce culture thing in this film, and how's it affect the character of Nancy, and Glenn's awful father.
Mm-hmm.
He'll call you tomorrow morning. You just gotta be still.
Oh my god.
So I feel like simultaneously, it's such a product of the 80s, but it was also a movie that was willing to kind of look at kids in the 80s and go like, no, these are simultaneously people who are right near adulthood and have to deal with things on their own because mom and dad aren't really around.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, they're just fucked up. That's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really like this. Let's move on and talk about the part three.
Well, before that, I want to also talk about, the sequences, like Tina afterwards, after her death, being in the body bag, and her hand running down the bloody body bag.
Mm-hmm. Yuck.
Is still super creepy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah, and her freak out in class.
And what do we make of the ending? And this is a good way to transition into the sequels, but what do we think of the end?
Oh, you mean like with the Catholicism stuff and that sort of thing, or what?
With the mom and being like, I think it's gonna be all right, and it's all sunny outside and then the Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, well, you had to know that, like, that's not how it's gonna end. Like, it wasn't just that easy. It was almost like Bill and Ted's when they're like, Ted, don't forget to hide the keys.
Well, what's interesting is, so this is where you get into all the world of the sequels and Wes Craven's problem with New Line. So the ending of the movie was essentially just supposed to be like, she gets in the car with her friends and drives off because Wes Craven did not see this as a series.
Hmm.
He saw this as a one and done, the story's over, the Freddy Krueger is defeated because Nancy says, I'm not going to give you any more power.
Yeah.
I'm ignoring you now. And that's the end. My story's done. Well, Bob Shea, owner of New Line and producer, was like, you got to give me something. You got to leave it open for a sequel. And him and Craven fought over that a lot. But Craven ended up acquiescing because Bob Shea was the only person who believed in his script. And he's like, okay, I will do this for you. Even despite the struggles of making the movie, it's actually interesting that there was a couple of times where Bob Shea was on set and was like, you got to go faster, you got to go faster. So Wes Craven was like, why don't you direct for a day? Let you see how you do it. and I guess Bob Shea left him alone after that. But there was one nightmare sequence that was one of Bob Shea's nightmares that Craven put into the script, and that's the running up the stairs and the stairs melting away.
Oh.
Like the
weird, yeah.
oatmeal stair floor thing, and Bob Shea talked about that.
Yeah,
that's something that happens as his nightmares is trying to run and not being able to.
Oh, yeah, that's something like I was thinking about today when I was driving and I was braking. I thought about how last night I had a dream where I was braking, but I couldn't brake, like, you know, like 2 feet on the brakes and you can't stop. That's the same kind of feeling like when you're running up the stairs and then like her feet get stuck. Mm-hmm. That same kind of thing where you're just like panically needing to stop or go somewhere and you can't and you're just stuck. Ugh, that feeling is just insane. Yeah.
And I have a lot of drowning dreams. I don't know what those mean.
Ooh, I've never had one of those.
They're terrible. You wake up gasping for air, which means you were holding your breath in your sleep. And so they come up with this ending, and on the DVD there's three alternate endings, and all of them are like, it's outside and Freddy's driving the car, or Freddy turns into the mom. Like, they couldn't figure out the ending, and the ending in the movie is obviously, you know, what they decided on, but even Wes Craven's like, I don't know what it means. They wanted to make a sequel, whatever. So they rush part two. Part two comes out the year after, and Wes Craven kind of felt a little screwed. Because the movie made a ton of money, he didn't see much of it. And part two was not well liked. It wasn't critically praised. It's kind of garnered a bit of a cult following in the, this is the truth, in the gay community. It's because the male lead in the film is dealing with all this stuff about there's something inside of me, I need to get out. It's Freddy Krueger. And Freddy wants to possess him, and there's all this other stuff. And the star and the director of part two are like, no, that wasn't intentional. But the writer of part two is like, yes, it was. So
interesting.
Look at that as you will. So then they take 2 years off, and they strike up a deal with Craven to write part three. So, Eric, if you want to
part three.
Introduce from there.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, obviously Nancy comes back. It's Nancy grown up. She is now, you know, an expert in dreams.
Oh, okay.
She's helping, yeah, like a little, like not quite like a, you know, asylum, but it's
like a therapy center or something like that.
Where, yeah, like a therapy center where you can't
where
get out.
Young adults are staying, maybe like as like a rehab for people that have had some kind of trauma in their life where they've done something physical or if they've had a mental breakdown and they're all being housed in the same place. She's coming in as an intern.
And it's worth noting they're all on suicide watch.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, they're all on suicide watch.
That kind of place, but it's not an insane asylum.
Yeah, and so, you know, she's there to be the one to solve all of these problems. And, you know, she's like basically like a dream expert or something like that. And what I think is so interesting about this, and what I like about this one so much, is that it's, you know, like Cameron and I have discussed, and he's mentioned to me, it's where Freddy Krueger becomes Freddy Krueger that we know. He's got the puns, he's got the one-liners, it's all of, you know, it's a little bit more silly, but it still has some parts that are very gross and scary. And, you know, it's one to note because, you know, Nancy dies at the end. And aside from that, I thought that the actual ending was a little disappointing, but I thought that it was worth noting because obviously Nancy dies, but, you know, the way that Freddy is kind of thwarted in this one left me a little like, oh, really? Like, all right. So, but yeah, but this is where we have a lot of cool deaths. It's a lot more like, oh, look how they killed her this time. Like, holy shit, come back here and look at this. You know, I was doing that a lot to Annelle when we had the DVD, and it was like, no, come back here and look at this one. Like, look at how this lady gets killed. So it was a lot of fun. I thought that I had a lot of fun with this one, actually. It was a lot more fun, I think, than the first one, but it's not as good of a film as the first one. Strauss, what did you think of this? I know that you particularly like the puppet string veins.
Oh, I was just going to say that was like, it was a lot more graphic where he is being a puppeteer.
Yeah, he's got
one of the guys in the same asylum.
Cruz, he's got the guy, like, they basically are slitting open his arms and his legs, and they're pulling out, like, his veins, essentially.
And he has,
that sounds lovely.
To make him like a marionette.
Yeah, like a marionette, yeah.
and just walking him down the hallway. And then finally he figures out what's going on. He's trying to fight it, and then he just throws him off the balcony.
Yeah, he cuts the strings and the guy.
What do you mean he figures out what's going on?
Well, the guy's awake.
Fighting. Like he's still alive?
Yeah. And just.
Well, I mean, it's in his dreams. He's just walking around.
You can't see what's going on. He just looks like he's going to jump off the balcony. In his dreams, he's being controlled by this marionette. And so you can see all the blood and guts. So the people that are his friends and
that's so gross.
Are watching him like, no, don't jump, man, don't jump.
Yeah.
And in his head, he's like, no, please don't do this to me. And then he gets cut by the strings, and it looks like he just jumped off the balcony, but really he was.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah. But that was the.
That's really gross.
That was the most intense death. Although I think maybe my favorite was the young woman who, first of all, tries to burn herself, or does burn herself with a cigarette. To stay awake. And then she's the one that Anel mentioned earlier that was eating the spoonful of coffee, and then.
No. The spoonful of coffee and Diet Coke is Patricia Arquette.
Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, this is a different lady.
Oh, well, shit. Who's the lady that goes through the TV?
Just a patient.
That's the cigarette girl. That's the cigarettes.
Yeah.
Okay, it's the cigarette girl. Okay, yeah, that's the one. That's the death that I like, and that's when he's got the. You know, the TV has these mechanical arms that go out the side, and his head comes out the top of the TV, and he shoves her head through the TV. And
well, he shoves her head before. It's the most famous Freddy Krueger line. This is the line Robert Englund says he has to sign anytime he signs an autograph, which is, welcome to prime time, bitch.
Yeah, that's right. Because she's watching TV.
Yeah.
And then.
Well, because she wants to be an actress.
Yes.
And she sees Zsa Zsa Gabor on The Tonight Show, I believe.
With Dick Cavett.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, for me, I love part three, and I think part three, you know, it's the thing, you know, when we talked about the first Connery Bond films, it's that thing that's interesting about watching a series is you finally see when they solidify what is their formula. So in like Nightmare Part Two, you know, people are getting killed who are awake, and Freddy comes into the real world and all this other stuff, and they haven't quite figured out what the formula was, because part one doesn't really have much of a formula yet because it wasn't supposed to be a franchise. And part three is where they completely figure it out and go, this is what this is. Wes Craven wrote the script with somebody. That script was taken, and it was apparently very dark, like very dark. But they had the whole idea of like, there was, and because again, taking from what was happening in the world, there was a lot of teen suicides going on at this time. So Craven took that idea and it's like, what if everyone thinks they're teen suicides, but it's actually Freddy?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that's where the idea sprung from for part three. It was very dark, and New Line was like, well, this is super dark. What if we give this to two guys who are up and coming writers who could maybe make it a little more fun, but keep this basic structure. And they gave it to Chuck Russell, who ended up directing the movie. Chuck Russell then went on to do The Blob, the 80s Blob, which is a lot of fun. The Mask.
No, it's not. I was scared of the bath mat for like 3 years.
I love The Mask.
The Jim Carrey Mask.
It was so bad, but it was so good for me at the time.
That was actually, it'd be interesting
that's what
to talk
she
about
said.
The Mask at some point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The Mask was originally supposed to be a 90s version of Nightmare on Elm Street. Same studio, New Line, and that comic is a horror comic. The Mask is a horror comic.
Oh, well, it came out funny.
But when they hired Jim Carrey, they were like, oh, we got to do this differently.
Yeah.
But Chuck Russell, he did The Mask, and his last big film was The Scorpion King. The Rock.
Oh, yeah.
Scorpion King.
Who was that, The Rock?
With The Rock, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But who Chuck Russell co-wrote this with, which is the big deal for me, Frank Darabont.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
This was Frank Darabont's first big job. They then went on as a writing team to go write The Blob together. And then obviously Frank Darabont went into Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile. And other great things.
And The Mist?
The Mist. Every fucking time on both of those.
Yeah, the Mist, which I think we're going to talk about in our next episode, was exciting for me because I was like, Craig Darabont's returning to horror. They brought in the more fun elements of this film. Chuck Russell often says, he's like, yeah, I guess I'm the guy you could blame for making Freddy Krueger funny. Sorry. But what I like about this movie is it does what I think a good sequel should do, is it expands on the mythology of Freddy Krueger without answering the mythology.
Mm.
We don't find out how he's able to be a dream demon, because it doesn't matter. But we add to his mythology of finding out who his mother is, where he came from, and that became like a big thing too for this franchise, is the bastard son of 100 maniacs.
Fucking Catholics is all I was saying about that.
Sure.
Wow.
But, you find out where he's buried.
Oh, right, yeah.
All these elements where you are adding to the mythology of Freddy Krueger, but you're not explaining it, so thus taking away. Also the fact that then the character of Freddy Krueger, it's easy to just say, oh, he got funny, but it's also the fact that his kills now are based upon the characters he's killing. Whereas in part one and part two, he does have his dream stuff, but for the most part, he just kind of slashes them open and that's it. This is the film that kind of solidifies, like, this person wants to be a star. I'm going to shove them into a TV. This person wants to be, this wizard character. I'm going to kill them with a medieval object. This person's a drug addict. I'm going to kill them with drugs.
Yeah, I see that too.
Taking those characters and furthering that thing of Freddy Krueger being a cruel son of a bitch who loves what he does, is he's, I'm going to kill you based on who you are and your personality.
And that's almost like a little bit Saw-esque.
Kind of.
Yeah, a little bit.
Where he finds the person and kills them in ways that are similar to things that have happened in their life.
Yeah.
And then I love
what he thinks they did wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I love the character, the updating they do with Nancy and Nancy's father. This is only 3 years later, but obviously because Heather Langenkamp was like 21 when they filmed the first one, so now she's like 24, 25 for this. She's at the exact age you would be when you get out of, you know, and start doing interning.
Mm-hmm.
I love that they keep the whole white streak of hair.
Yes.
I love that in the first one she was tired and looked in the mirror and said, I look 20.
Yes. But it works because, like, when you're that age, you still have, like, the baby fat cheeks. That everyone has, like, you still have those baby fat cheeks, so that's how you can play teenagers, but then it's 3 years later, all that stuff goes away. Mm-hmm. So it's completely believable for this film that despite the fact that it was made 3 years later, you can be like, okay, yeah, this character is now, by time-wise of the film's logic, like, 5-10 years later?
Yeah.
Because now she looks like a woman, not like a kid.
Well, no kid would have hair that big.
Fair enough. Well, it's the 80s, yes, they wouldn't. I just watched Monster Squad today. A lot of those junior high kids had huge hair.
Yeah,
confirmed.
That's the thing.
And the fact, too, that's like, I love the group of kids. I really like those group of kids. I like that they all have distinct personalities. They kind of did the John Hughes thing. You could almost look at these group of kids as the Breakfast Club.
Yeah, very much so.
There's the geek, the hot one, the this, the that, the weird one, blah, 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 blah. They're archetypes, but they're very likable archetypes. And when Freddy kills them, you know, in the first one, you know, it's all setting up what this world is. So you don't know Tina that well. You don't know her boyfriend. You know Glenn because he's Johnny Depp, but there's not a lot there. Because with this film, they decide to take these archetypes. You kind of are bummed out when certain characters die.
Yeah.
The creativity in the dream world, you know, now it's not just in the boiler room or Nancy's backyard. It's these hallways and corridors in this house and all this other stuff. And just the simple things of building out the world of Springwood. Like, what is the town of Springwood? In the first film, you know, you see like the high school, Nancy's house, Glenn's house, and the sleep, study place that Nancy goes to. In this film, you have the church, the cemetery, the local bar, the this, the that, like, it feels more like a living, breathing town, which then, when you understand who this character of Freddy Krueger is and what he did to this town, you then almost understand what the parents did.
Yeah.
And I love what happens with Nancy's father, how you meet him again, and he's now, like, an alcoholic.
That's ironic.
Yeah. Basically, probably because he just saw his wife get eaten into a bed. He probably got to drink that memory away.
Right.
And again, you then get into what we talked about with the parents thing again, where it's like you have these adults who are trying to think they're doing what's best for these kids. Like the one doctor in the group who is like, we're not going to talk about this fake bullshit anymore. And who doesn't want to prescribe them prescription drugs and all this other stuff, and is like, no, you people need to deal with reality. She's literally just trying to do what she thinks is best for these group of kids. But then I love Patricia Arquette's like yelling at her, being like, you're killing us, you stupid bitch. It's great. I love this movie.
Yeah, it's good. It also has the, isn't it, I believe it's this one, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's where she's sleeping and he comes through the headboard, right?
That's the first one.
But is that really?
Very
okay.
Good.
Son of a bitch. That's what happens when you watch them so close together. But that's my favorite Freddy Krueger effect, I think.
It's super simple. They went down. They were like, how are we going to do this push into the wall effect? And he was like, just go down to your local Joann Fabrics, get some like stretchy fabric. And that's it. It's just lit the right way.
Yeah, and it looks terrifying, though.
Yeah. Ugh. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Oof. So.
I don't know. Like, I think part one and part three, I think you could just watch the three that Wes Craven is involved in. And I think, like, you have, like, a really good series of films.
Sure. And we'll get into the next one on our next episode.
Yeah. And I mean, the others are interesting. And for me.
I
love Friday films. I love the Halloween films. I love those films. But I think Nightmare for me, I really appreciate it on a different level. And I think because they're allowed to be so creative. And this is the film where it starts, because again, like, tying the deaths into who the personalities of these kids are.
Well, I like that. I also like how he's this humongous like snake trying to like gobble someone up at
yes.
one point, and then he's like throwing it up, and I'm just like, oh my god, you don't know what's going to happen in a Nightmare on Elm Street film, to where in a Friday the 13th or a Halloween, it's like, okay, it's a dude and he's got an axe or he's got a knife or whatever. And here it's also, like, holy shit, anything can happen.
Well, it's also the series, too, where I think because you have to be more creative, and there's great Friday the 13th films and Halloween films outside just like the first ones. But if you look at this is not to say anything about anything, but if you look at this series and you look at who directed them, a lot of these directors went on to go do like other huge films and big things. The Friday series and the Halloween films, a lot of those guys kind of just went to go on and do TV work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because this series allows you to, you have to be creative. You have to film things in interesting ways. And especially this film knows how to create iconic moments. I think when Nancy gets pulled into the dream, which I love that concept, the concept of someone who can pull other people into their dreams.
Yeah.
When Nancy gets pulled into the dream and she sees Freddy Krueger, and it just Freddy Krueger's giant snake face says like, you, and then the camera does this slow dolly into Nancy's face and she just goes, oh my God. Like, it's such a great filmic, iconic little moment.
Yeah.
Like, that totally recognizes what this is, where it's like, these two have fought before. She's the one that got away. And it really soaks up that moment perfectly.
Yeah, it's really good. Cruz, I mean, if you you ever have a hankering to see it, I suggest you check it out, because it's definitely one to see.
Okay. I mean, and I know that he's like pretty pop culture, but I can honestly say that he's definitely not my favorite.
Oh, okay.
He's not, I think it has to do with the sarcasm and the being able to be a smartass, but like, that's not nearly as scary to me as like Michael Myers creepily standing behind like a bush waiting to just attack you and kill you.
Hmm. It's interesting. It is always interesting and pretty subjective. It's a little bit like comedy, to where, you know, not everything's funny to everyone, not everything's scary to everybody.
Right. And I mean, like I said, I did like the movie, but I think it has to do with like the realism of it. You know how like is it called The Visitors?
The Strangers.
That's like the scariest movie ever to me, because it's just creepy people in masks trying to kill you. And I mean, like, this has definitely scary parts, but like, you know, I think the fact that he's like kind of, you know, I don't know, like, he seems more in control of what he's doing, I guess, cause he like enjoys it, and he seems to like have some sort of personality. Whereas like Michael Myers, like, I feel like he's so fucked up in the head that like he just doesn't have a choice. Like, he's just like killing people cause he is like weird about it. I don't know.
Interesting.
I don't know.
Interesting. All right. Well, yeah. I mean, speaking of the strangers, we'll have a film next time that's very, very much responsible for the strangers. So, do we have anything else?
Great.
Do we have anything else to say about any of these films before we move on? Cameron, do you have anything else?
No, I don't think so. I think what's interesting is talking about from our first, you know, in the '70s, you know, Carpenter, Argento, those guys, like a lot of those films were like, Toby Hooper, like their first films are the films that put them on the map. These three films were films that kind of redefined established directors. Which I think is interesting.
That is interesting. Huh. I guess I hadn't really thought about that.
Yeah.
Cruz, do you have anything else to add before we wrap this up?
I'm kind of scared for next time.
All right. I like that. Strauss, how about you?
I liked these.
You did like these.
Yeah, they were scary for me.
They weren't the sequels.
No, so it was great. Yeah. First times, liked it.
That's good. Yeah, I think I'm good as well. So, Cruz, why don't you wrap us up?
All right. If you have any comments for the show or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about, please feel free to email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us over at Twitter at plainlabelpod, where you can follow Eric at EricWilliams79. And I mean, I'm not good at the Twitter. We've already chatted, but you can tweet me at LadyZlag, and I'm sorry in advance. You can also follow Nell over at Anel Elizabeth and Cameron at Jurassic Alien. And we have a Facebook page where you can like the show. Just search Plain Label Podcast. And we want to thank Anel and Cameron for coming on. And if people wanted to learn more from Anel, they could check out the recent Podchat episode on Enemy and Fed Up. And if they want to hear more from Cameron, go ahead and let us know where we can find you.
As said, JurassicAlienTour.com. You can also find my shows, Cameron Watches Movies. Been on a little bit of a break. We just did an episode about the recent superhero shows that premiered. Also, launching a new show. By the time this comes out, hopefully it'll be out Friday, called Geek Flashback. And it's me and an improv buddy of mine pick geeky movies and talk about them. And the first episode is the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, nice.
And the concept of that show is to look at them and go, try and look at them from the series of being an adult and being like, do these hold up? Is this just nostalgia? Do this still work? FYI, Ninja Turtles still works. It's a beautiful film.
Totally.
Other than that, filmographies with me and Eric. I think next week, by the time the third episode of this comes out, the first Freakin' should be out.
Oh, yeah.
My goal is to get the second episode out pre-Halloween, because somebody had to defend The Exorcist.
And it wasn't me, and it wasn't Gabe.
Nice. All right. Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our look at horror movies from the 90s and beyond.
shit.
You saw me standing without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Can I have a piece of toast?